This is MuggleCast, your Harry Potter and Fantastic Beasts podcast covering everything about J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. Welcome to MuggleCast episode 299. Let me repeat that. 299. We are approaching our 300th episode, which is crazy. Selena is back. Welcome, Selena.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm back to ruin everything, clearly.
No, it's great to have you on. I think this is the first time you're on since actually seeing Cursed Child.
I think you're right. Oh yeah. My God, I have so many thoughts.
I know. Perfect.
The new voice of reason.
Selena. Yay! I'm very excited to be the voice of reason. I don't think I'll do a very good job, but I'll do my best.
And of course, Eric and Micah are here. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Eric was nerding out at Wizard World Chicago this weekend.
That's right. You guys, I met the smoking man.
Oh,
who was
wow,
that?
From
X-Files.
That
the X-Files?
Yeah, oh, X-Files. Cool. Yeah, or Lost. You know, you can choose.
I don't know. I just assume Eric's always talking about Lost. Were you wearing your cloak at the convention?
You know, I will today, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay.
Going to go around, okay. Yeah.
Excellent.
Are you podcasting live from the convention right now?
You know, I'm not. I'm podcasting from my living room. I wanted to make sure that there was as much of a controlled environment for sound as possible this time.
Why?
You know, just a good practice in general.
Yes,
the right
absolutely.
Mic selected and all that stuff. But I don't know, maybe
the professionalism, Eric.
Thank you.
Very impressed.
Thank you, Micah. It's
300 episodes and finally getting it together.
Finally getting it together, yeah.
Good for you.
Appreciate it.
And what's the temperature today in Chicago?
Ooh, it's a balmy 71.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a huge rainstorm. It dropped the temperature like 20 degrees, so it's really enjoyable.
That's good cloak weather. That's why I asked. I was wondering if you'd be sweating your somethings off.
The conventions are always very air conditioned. So
excellent. Well, this is our big Cursed Child Part 2 episode. Last 2 weeks ago, we did Part 1, mm-hmm. and now we're going to wrap up the story, the 8th story, with our discussion on Part 2. Lots to talk about in this one. But first, I actually just wanted to start with an email from Matthew, one of our supporters on Patreon. He just responded to our Cursed Child Part 1 discussion. He said that he, too, had many problems with the story, but I wanted to focus on one part that you guys discussed, specifically the security in Hermione's office. Yes, it seemed rather outrageous that the puzzles in the bookcase were able to be solved by a pair of teenagers. However, I think it's important to recall that at the end of Book 1, certain 11-year-olds were able to foil the traps and puzzles set by some of the greatest witches and wizards at Hogwarts. Not saying that that isn't a little far-fetched either, but from a plot perspective, I don't feel like you can forgive one scenario and not the other.
But isn't that exactly why Hermione should have known better?
Yes, it is.
Thank you,
Selena. Thank you.
Maybe, see,
voice
Selena is the voice of reason. On our side, apparently. No.
Sorry, guys.
That would be my response, is that they should have learned from what they were themselves able to do, as Matthew points out, in their first year. So you would think the security would be even stronger, even better than what was the case at the end of Philosopher's Stone. So,
yeah.
Sorry, Matt.
But it's clearly like a tone callback, though. Like, they did it to echo the first book, so it's fine, but it's not fine that Hermione, the Minister of Magic, would think this is a good idea.
And on stage, it's a very fun scene, because mm-hmm. they get sucked into the bookcase and they get spit back out. It's one of my favorites on stage, actually.
Yeah, it worked.
I believe
really
that.
Well.
That seems to be a recurring thing as I'm going through part two, acts 3 and 4 again, just seeing how much stuff that would clearly be really cool to see on stage, as much as I might disagree with why it's happening.
It's kind of like a slap in the face. It's like, oh yeah, this would be really cool if...
But it shouldn't happen. You almost hate yourself for being like, oh, I would enjoy seeing that.
Hmm.
Well, it's not only, and just to go back to the email for a second, the way that they're able to break into the office and to, you know, get the time turner. What bothered me was just the fact that they were able to get into the ministry, much like Harry, Ron, and Hermione do in the books. You would think that in all the years, right, since mm-hmm. this took place, there'd be something that would have been put in place to prevent against people posing as others to get into the ministry, right? You're talking about the ministry here.
Oh, yeah. Or Hogwarts, you know, especially after all of the battling and all of the death that took place, the fallen 50, everybody who died in the war, you know, in their honor, find a way to make better security. There's a point in, I think it's part 3, Delphi's like, oh man, Hogwarts has really lacked security, doesn't it? And I was just like, you suck, you should die, but also you shouldn't be allowed to just walk onto the grounds. And, you know, it's a big question for me. It's one of the biggest problems that I have ruminating is this issue of security in the future Wizarding World. There's a case to be made that they got lax and careless because they forgot. You know, they forgot, like,
there's no threats anymore.
Yeah, like the kids who grew up never knowing Voldemort, sure. But these are the adults who fought in the first and, well, probably first, possibly first, and definitely second Wizarding World Wars. Better yourself, you know, get the right skills that you need to actually hold these positions of government that you have, and, you know, make the place more secure. Come on. I mean,
just relate to real life, though? Like, do we really get smarter? This is a whole other discussion.
I'd like to believe we do.
I don't.
Yeah.
I do not.
Have you seen the current political situation in this country? You think we've gotten smarter?
So I'm the only one not being cynical right now. Let the record show. 299. Let the record show.
Maybe that's another discussion for millennial or
maybe
a separate podcast. We don't want to go that direction. But
man.
It's a good point that Matthew raises. There is the comparison to what Harry, Ron, and Hermione did in their first year, but I think it ends there because we're seeing it through a completely different lens, and maybe that's because we're older and we see things differently than we did when we read, you know, Sorcerer's Stone. Perhaps if we read them more as adults, we would have said, well, why is the security so lax in Hogwarts that you can just wander into the forbidden area that you're not supposed to be in and use cheesy, easy spells to get through locked doors. So
yeah, but Dumbledore wanted them to, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
So it was kind of a different situation.
Mm, we'll talk about him later, too.
Yeah. Yes, we will. A couple more pieces of feedback from MuggleCast.com. You may know that our new website now boasts a comment section for each episode.
Oh, my.
Yeah. EB writes, I know, how modern, right?
Like, I know. Comment section. Next, forums.
You would think that in this day and age, we would have other means for people to contact us, but no.
Yeah. No, you can contact us in a bunch of ways. Anyway, EB writes, in line with the relationship between Harry and Albus, this period in his life, early adolescence, 12 plus, is when the children and parents have their most difficult struggles. So I can't assume that Harry never knew his son. His son is just beginning a new stage of life. Also, rebellious children don't try to rewrite history, but Albus's father was not a regular person. He's the most famous wizard alive, and Albus wants to do something comparable. It's one of the rules of parenthood. Don't speak in anger. Take a break, because you say things that you don't really mean. Harry is echoing what his son Albus had just said when he says he sometimes wishes he weren't his father. And that was in response to our discussion of that particular point. A lot of people were shocked by Harry saying to Albus, I wish you weren't my son, in light of Harry losing his own parents. How could he say such a thing? But that's a good point. And as I brought up on the last episode, yes, parents and their children do get in very heated fights, including the one I mentioned with my mother.
Yeah.
It's I fault. This is maybe the voice of reason part. I definitely, in that particular quandary, like, I fall on the side that this was a good choice just because it added some realism to the thing and to Harry not being a perfect person or a perfect father. And he does make mistakes like everyone else. And it's hard to say because it played so well on stage that it definitely impacts our understanding of it as opposed to just reading it flat out on the page. Like, Harry says these words, but for me, it was in character in a bad way, but it worked, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Let's see. We got some other feedback here. No, I didn't think any of. They're kind of long, so I didn't want to read it. But we'll move on.
We do appreciate always feedback responses for Cursed Child. I get a lot on Twitter as well for my opinions. And it's great to have these kinds of discussions and to have these kinds of dialogues about these characters. This book is not going away. This play, this script, is going to be with us for a long time. And
thanks for the reminder.
Much as I would like it, nobody's going to jump out from behind the curtains and say, just kidding. So the more that we discuss,
are you sure about
things,
that?
I'm losing.
We still have the definitive script edition.
The definitive script edition. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where it takes place entirely in 2019. Yes. And
one thing
no time travel.
I would just add, though, and I know you can't control how people respond, but you know, we're just four people with opinions, you know, and we're certainly interested in what you have to say, but do it in a nice way. Respond in a nice way if it's possible, because I think some of the things that I've seen are just really outlandish in terms of claims and opinions, more so directed at us than the actual story itself. So that's all I'll
say.
That's
the internet for you.
Yeah. I know. We've only been doing this for 11 years.
Well,
so.
And my whole point was to, like, the more we talk about it, the more okay with this we hope to become. You know, the more we talk out these issues, we'll find common grounds inevitably, and we'll dislike this play less. Hmm. For those of
like
us who
all traumas.
It. Oh, geez. Traumas or
I'm
dramas?
I'm kidding. Traumas, not dramas.
So forget it. Then don't be nice. Just be constructive based on what Eric just said.
Thank you.
There you go. So a quick Patreon update before we get into our Cursed Child Part 2 discussion. Our patrons helped us unlock Mega MuggleCast.
Mega MuggleCast. I don't know what
and
that was.
And just in time
Godzilla
for
to-
episode 300. So on our next episode, slated for early September, we'll be bringing back a bunch of old hosts for a big celebration to celebrate 300 episodes. And I mean, that doesn't even include the mini MuggleCast and the leaky mugs and all these others. So we're kind of well over 300, but this is our 300th core episode, I guess you could say, main show episode. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty exciting. So everybody gets to look forward to that in early September.
Thank you. And congrats to our patrons for hitting that milestone.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much. So let's move on to The Cursed Child Part 2.
Boom.
And what?
Oh. I said boom.
Oh, okay. So, boom. As we all may remember, we left off at the end of part one with Scorpius and Albus really screwing things up to the point where Albus wasn't even alive.
Voldemort Day!
Question mark. Curtain.
Voldemort and Valor to y'all.
For Voldemort and Valor.
It was so big that it took over the merchandise tables at the Cursed Child at the Palace Theater.
Wow.
So it was a big deal.
Now, yeah. Andrew and Selena both, I guess, I can ask the question, were you seeing the play because it was in preview in the same day? So you were coming back later,
two
or you had to wait?
We had to wait two whole days because it was on a Tuesday and a Thursday, I think.
Right.
So it was a long time to process everything and make theories about part two that didn't come true.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I think I've talked about this before. The part one cliffhanger didn't feel like a cliffhanger to me because things had become so undone in the wizarding world that it was obvious that everything was going to get fixed again.
That was one of the biggest spoilers to come out of part one that did not come from Hyperbole, by the way, but was that Harry died. And they were like, that was the spoiler that was sort of making the rounds to people that wanted spoilers. But it was so, it felt so cheap because it was obvious that he wasn't dead, because, like, first of all, it was part one, so clearly there was a whole other part where he wasn't just going to be dead, but also there was time travel involved and everything else was different. Like, there was never a question that this would be undone.
But I think it's kind of exciting that the box of worms gets opened up right at the very end, and then there's the curtain.
Oh, I definitely agree. I mean, it's cool to end on that, like, in an entirely different world. I think it was just because it felt like, pacing-wise, that this was just yet another alternate reality that they were going to have to undo. And because both Harry and Albus were gone, we were all like, well, this can't last very long because it's literally just Scorpius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
I think I mentioned this on a prior podcast, too, is that at least when reading it, it reminded me a lot of Deathly Hallows Part 1 when Voldemort gets the Elder Wand. And, you know, that's end of part one, and you're kind of left in this cliffhanger, but you know that things are going to turn out okay in the end. So I'm wondering if it seems like it was a similar sort of experience on your end.
Yeah, it really was. But, you know, to be honest, what really bummed me out especially about part two. And it is sort of like, because we had all that time to make up our own theories and thoughts and expectations, me and Kyle from Hypable, we were convinced that in part two, like, Rose was finally going to have her day. Oh. And she was going to still be around. And she and Scorpius were going to fix everything. Because we've talked, I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked about, like, Scorpius a lot and stuff. And at that point, I was like, they're not going to do it. There's no way they're actually going to be that awesome. So it's fine. They're going to go with Scorpius and Rose. That's totally, I was totally okay with that. And I was like, it's okay because she's going to get to be a hero and save the day. And they're going to bond. And that didn't happen.
Right. So it's like, because you're in your head, I'm sure you're probably trying to reconstruct this idea of a new trio.
Yeah. Because I was like, Rose, she's not in the play at all. I was like, where the hell is she? She has to have a moment at some point that validates, like, you know, that she was in all the main promo pictures and that she's like the new main character and that she's Hermione's daughter and all that stuff. So that would have been the perfect time, but it didn't happen. Well, I was super disappointed for the rest of the play.
You just had to wait till the very, very end. Selena.
Oh, yeah. She gets to go on a date. I mean, what's she complaining about? That's what all girls want.
You know what happens to Hermione when she doesn't get a date. She becomes an evil Snape-like potions professor.
Yeah, I was cracking up about that last week. Implying that Hermione needs a man to be happy.
Yeah. It was D-A-D-A. I said potions. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It's fine.
So in this alternate reality at the beginning of Act 3, we're focused on Scorpius because he's the only one left and he's a talented Quidditch player, unlike his father. Yes. And I found this interesting because I'm actually rereading Chamber of Secrets right now. And I recently got past that scene where Lucius buys the brooms for the team so Draco could play with them. So I thought that was interesting. He's kind of the opposite of his father. And with Umbridge at the helm, they're torturing Mudbloods, which was apparently the idea of Scorpius, who's known as the Scorpion King.
Oh my God.
Like, do you smell what Scorpius is cooking?
Again, getting back to Chamber of Secrets, Draco, as a boy, would have loved this because he's talking about how he doesn't want Mudbloods at the school.
Okay, but do you think, I mean, let's be real, Scorpius, in any reality, would enjoy having kids tortured in the dungeon? Like, it's such an absurd, like, on the stage too, you could hear the screams of the kids. And it's like, there's no way, not Draco either, I don't think, would like relish in that kind of reality.
So you're
it
like
just
saying,
seems so weird.
Even how Snape in this reality is like secretly good the whole time because he didn't change, you think it's like just too much of a stretch for Scorpius and Draco to be that way?
Yeah. Yes.
I think it is the one thing that the play does not go out of their way to explain, right? Everything else, every crazy, preposterous plot, like why Amos Diggory did what he did, why Cedric turned evil. Exactly. Why Voldemort's still alive because of Cedric turning. Like, everything was, like, given some sort of weird explanation, whether you like it or not, but not the Scorpius being evil bit.
Right. I guess it's fine. Like, it's just, like, because he grew up differently. Like, taking the whole thing aside of if the entire reality was different, there's no way that Draco and Astoria would have conceived the exact same child at the exact same time. Like, even taking that out of it, you could say, okay, well, he grew up to be a psychopath, and this is his life if he was a psychopath. But
yeah,
The world that he lives in is much different, right? With Voldemort in power, so I think that could have some level of influence on him, especially growing up, knowing that he is the son of, or I guess grandson of somebody who was a prominent Death Eater in Voldemort's inner circle. But even later on, I thought we learned more about Lucius and. I found it interesting that really there was a part of him that would have preferred a world without Voldemort. Mm. And that gets mentioned later on when Draco is talking with Harry in Harry's office. But those are the types of moments that I liked to read in this story, and things that seemed like they were in fact coming from J.K. Rowling, because there's definitely parts that don't seem like they're coming from her, and I know we've touched on that. You can tell, and you know, I'm just even the last episode that we did when we were talking about the trolley lady and how we had hoped that that was something that J.K. Rowling had written in and not something that was added by, you know, John Tiffany or Jack Thorne. So I just, those types of moments as a reader and somebody who's enjoyed the series over the years, you know, are moments that I can appreciate. But it still just overall that this whole story, it, you know, even in talking with friends and that have read this, you know, they're sure that it translates into this amazing story, you know, on stage, but outside of it, it just seems like a really bad piece of fan fiction.
Well, yeah, it's kind of the recurring trend here.
Yeah, let's not tread back into that.
But could I say one more thing about
I was just looking for
world?
Selena's thought.
Well, I think I agree. But I was just going to say one thing about this world that I find really sketchy. Like actually when you think about it, this is a very, very interesting alternate take on what the premise of the Harry Potter could have been, where all of these mudbloods all of these muggleborns, Jesus.
Wow, jeez. Selena, come on.
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to call you
Selena's the Scorpion King.
Muggleborns. This is the alternate reality, Selena. Being tortured in the dungeon. They have all been sent to Hogwarts by parents who presumably have no idea and think that this is like this really nice school of magic. Yeah. So imagine a world where the premise of a Hogwarts is just a setup to get kids to be tortured. In a dungeon. How terrifying. Yeah. They like have to trick them and take them to Diagon Alley and stuff. And then they get on the train and it's like,
brrr. I'm so excited. This is so great.
Oh God. To what end?
Trolley lady is totally normal and not creepy.
They take them
secretly
to Hogwarts just to torture them instead of just not allowing them to go to Hogwarts.
This is very clearly meant to be. And I think at one point Scorpius calls it hell, right? Like the hell. This is the hellscape.
Yeah, the hell dimension.
The narrative purpose of this is to show like the absolute worst consequence that you could possibly think of, like messing with time. This is the
and
Back
this is
to
not
the Future.
Realistic.
This is the Back to the Future 2 of the play, where you just go into this thing and this will be ultimately the most flawed because it's played for emotion. You're supposed to be shocked. You're supposed to be awed, you know, sort of into just accepting that this is terrible and they're going to try and fix it.
Or alternate idea, they are this was a newish thing, torturing the mudbloods.
Could be.
Right, because what was Scorpius' idea?
Because how could this not get out at the school or beyond the school? And then how could parents send their kids there knowing that this would happen? So
but they didn't know. You know, that's the scary horror part of this
story. They didn't know, but inevitably they would. At some point, it would have
to get
out.
Or they were forced. I mean, don't forget the world that they're living in. I mean, they probably have limited control. I'm interested to know the impact that all of this going on would have on our world because we saw the crossover, right? A lot of it in Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah.
Who knows what's going on in our world that sort of mimics what's
kids
happening.
Kids are just being tortured and disappear and never come home.
I will say the most interesting thing for me in this hell world is the role of the augury. Because at this point in the play, we do not know who or what that is. It's purposefully revealed much later. But like the Umbridge in the beginning scene quotes the augury. She says, to Scorpius about changing his future, about, you know, not being so darn weird all of a sudden. She says, like the augury insists, the future is ours to make. And I was thinking, this is a great quote for somebody who just like successfully affected, you know, time travel that brought this world upon us all. The augury in this world is like a time lord or time master, clearly.
Well, it's Delphi.
Yeah, but Delphi, in this reality, like Delphi in this reality, maybe still used time travel to bring about Voldemort's success, like the Delphi that we're seeing. Because like Delphi in during part one, we mentioned this last week, Selena. It like the creatures that are all on the move, like the giants and everything, have augury tattoos on the back of them.
Oh,
so
of course,
Delphi was totally recruiting in the real world before she approached like Albus and Scorpius, which is really weird because it doesn't get paid off. But like Delphi is a force for evil in the current world, and she's causing things to happen that just never really come up in the play.
So, I wanted to ask you guys what you think the Scorpion King is exactly, because we never know, we never learn what, how this role came to be. Was it just dreamed up between, is it basically being Umbridge's understudy? Because Umbridge mentions that they work together, or implies that they work together. So I'm wondering what exactly it is. Is it just to come up with all these, he seems to be some sort of leader in the school. Is he in charge of just treating the mudbloods like crap?
Yes. I guess that kind of makes sense. Like they sort of pick children from Wizards of Provenant families and they give them power to keep them sort of sated in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
That's what I took away from it, and I think that it was reminiscent of when Draco and Crabbe and Goyle were all part of Umbridge's inquisitorial squad.
In this world, the government, having been overthrown clearly by Voldemort, would be tighter linked to Hogwarts. So, like, you have Scorpius, whose dad is a ministry official, has the same job that Harry has in the real timeline, and is just, you know, a deputy of some of sorts for both the government and for Umbridge, who's ruling.
Okay. So Scorpius is very confused by everything that's going on, but he learns from Snape how this all came to be, how he ended up being the Scorpion King, and how Voldemort Day and Voldemort and Valor, all this. So he learns from Snape, who's still alive, which was pretty surprising, that Cedric was so humiliated due to Albus and Scorpius's twist in the second task that he became a Death Eater after killing Longbottom.
As anyone would.
Right. So Neville's death meant that Nagini didn't die, thus Voldemort won the battle. So a lot of people had a problem with this, with Cedric becoming a Death Eater. It just doesn't seem in his character, does it?
Because he becomes a vampire, right?
Yeah, right. This is the wrong path for him. No, I mean, you're right. That's the thing that bothers a lot of people about this play is how easily it does away with things that mattered so much in the original series. One of them is the rules of time travel, and another one is this. Cedric was such a symbol. And I think it's not so much that he could be, because in a way, I like the idea that the symbol of hope in our reality could become so corrupted and a force of evil in the other reality. But I just think it's too easy. It's too convenient. It's too much. Like the rest of this alternate world, it's just too cheap to feel like it has impact. Like the idea of Cedric being corrupted in itself is a pretty good idea if the play was about, well, I was going to say about Cedric. It kind of was. But you know what I mean? Like it just feels... Yeah.
The idea that nobody's safe, the idea nobody's that pure of heart that can withstand the temptations of the Dark Lord, et cetera, et cetera. It's a prime example of that, but it's almost like a catchphrase. It's almost thrown out there like just to gnaw on it until the next line of dialogue distracts the audience from the whole situation. Also, these kids know an impossible amount about Harry's life. Which I can already see the angry tweets I'll get. No, they don't. Clearly there were books all about it, but like the idea about the Horcruxes and knowing that Nagini had to die in order for Voldemort to die, that Scorpius knows this, which is weird. It's not Albus saying this.
I don't think it's weird at all. I think because Scorpius is very well read. That's established multiple times throughout this book. He's the Hermione.
It's a big part of when they go back in time to Godric's Hollow, right? He has so much knowledge about Harry's family, as he's talking about the statue and other things like that, that Albus has absolutely no clue about. So
when you talk about a Mary Sue, though, you talk about an impossibly gifted, smart character who is, you know, really knows more and does more than he should be allowed to or do.
Scorpius. That was Hermione as well.
I like Scorpius in this play a whole heck of a lot. He's a great character, but it's awfully convenient for them to put them in these situations that are so preposterous and have Scorpius level-headed getting him out.
One defense. But I wanted to ask a question in terms of how this all translated onto the stage, because to me, just saying that Cedric was so humiliated, right?
Yeah.
What was so humiliating that would drive you to the point of becoming evil, becoming a Death Eater? Because from what we know of Cedric's character, that wasn't who he was. And that's why I think it's probably difficult for a lot of people to, you know, really, you know, be
get
okay
on board with this.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is they used year four too, which is what they shouldn't have done, because in year four, the Goblet of Fire, this completely omniscient, sort of, you know, character, this judge of character, picked Cedric as the champion for Hogwarts, right? Like, this seems to be the last kid who would ever become a Death Eater.
I don't think those two are necessarily, like, mutually exclusive, but I think Goblet of Fire in general does so much to establish Cedric as the kind of character who wouldn't, be so humiliated from riding naked on a purple broom or whatever the hell that he would
with
kill
with feathers coming
button.
Out his
like,
butt,
it just doesn't,
whatever it was.
Right. Like, it just doesn't seem like a thing that would happen.
On stage, it just moves so fast that you don't even really have time to think about it.
One of those things where I was like, what?
Yeah. And like, Cedric, it's not like they dwell on Cedric, so you can't really even see his humiliation at all. So no. I think that if they did, maybe it would have played better, but yeah they
don't.
It's
one of those things they ask you to accept as fact. Yeah. And it's not like you can't sit here and be like, yeah, you know, it's nice to see that even nice people can be corrupted, blah, blah, blah. But it's still like you hear it on stage, you read it in the script, you're like, why? Like, wait, hold on.
And that's what you have to do for really reading this whole book. You just got to suspend your disbelief.
Right. Oh, well, forget those other seven books.
Right.
I have another question, though.
Okay.
Because we see Scorpius spending so much time, in at least in this act, at Hogwarts. How is it that he never happened across himself in all of this, right? He never once comes across himself?
Well,
no, he is himself. Yeah, he's not time traveling.
Well, is
he's
in
the
present
day. He's back to the future, but the future has changed.
The way that works, isn't it like the him... Presumably, the only way that would work is if the him of the present time period also got a hold of a time turner at the same exact time and is currently in the past. Is that right? Because that's how it seems to me the first two times, right?
Yeah, they changed time. They went back and changed time. Then they came back to reality, to present day. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing in part two when it starts off is present day. So things were changed in the past. They're now in present day. So whatever year it is.
That makes more sense.
Which is such a fundamental problem with doing a story like this, is that you have to assume that in the future, you go forward to a time where you look exactly the same. You are the same person. Like they did, it wasn't like I said, like Draco and Astoria would have had to have made a baby at the exact same time to get the exact same result. He would have had to be exactly as tall, be exactly as thin or not thin. And like, you know, he could have been Scorpia. but like Albus didn't exist, but Scorpius was still exactly the same, but the world around him had changed, which is a little bit hard to swallow in stories like that.
Well, he's not exactly the same, though. I mean, he's the Scorpion King, and he's a great Quidditch player. So there are things that are different.
But he looks the same, you know? Mm. Like, he doesn't feel different. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Hermione was noticeably different when she was altered, when she didn't have Ron in her life.
She was sad.
Still laugh at that. So... Moving along here, I will say, and I know we've been critiquing the past few minutes, the one character that did not work for me in the play was Snape, because Alan Rickman did such a fantastic job of bringing that character to life that the Snape in this play did not have the same voice, and that really killed it for me. It was very different. And
he was just a guy. Like, he was just an old, sad guy.
He didn't have a certain tone or anything.
I don't
like
think
every
this
other
is
character
fair.
Worked. McGonagall, Dumbledore, all these others. Fair. But Snape, I guess it just speaks to how great Alan Rickman was, but it just didn't work for me.
I just think I've seen some criticism about Snape in this play, the character though, not the actor. I can't say anything about the actor. I didn't see the play. But this this idea that it's really the play is very Snape apologetic. J.K. Rowling leaves Snape in such a very important kind of in-between position. People are still to this day talking about it at conventions about whether he was good or evil. And this play just continues to show that, oh, he's a great guy after all, right? He hears this story, he listens to Scorpius, and he's just like, oh yeah, and I've been leader of this resistance. Once I realized that I couldn't save Lily, I began to devote myself to the cause. And you know what? I may have even believed in it. Silly me. And he's chiding, Ron. He's going against, like, making these snide little remarks, and it's played for comedy. And it's just like, oh man, he was a nice guy after all. Like, I kind of like where they left Snape in the end, like tragic, flawed, but not this, you know, source for humor where, cause he can, like, it's finally okay to make light of, or it's finally fun to laugh at with Snape when he's making fun of somebody. And I'm like, I don't know how I feel about that.
The fact that Snape is friends with Hermione and Ron just does not ring true to me in any reality. And that's actually one thing that was really fun, like really weird on stage. I don't think Andrew read it the same way I did, but definitely some of the other people from High People who went and saw it. The interactions between Hermione and Snape were like too familiar. Like they weird. Got too close to each other.
Well, you know, they got just
right up in each other's faces.
Could it be that the play just made Hermione an almost Snape-like character in the previous timeline? Don't you think there's something there?
I don't know. I mean, there's also some stuff like for the Dramini shippers. I'm thinking, I mean, to be honest, I read it as though they were in a relationship, and I have been told that that is very wrong. But the way they acted with each other on stage, the close, like the intimacy between the two actors in those scenes just threw me completely off.
You were
off.
A moderately acceptable wizard.
Like, they were just, and she was like, Severus, and she was like, inches from his face, and I was like, are they gonna kiss?
Look, these are people who have probably 15 years together in this hole underneath the Wampa Gallo.
They could be.
I'm trying to make the opposite case. Like, they just work in close proximity, they have these ideals, but there's so few of them.
I don't know. I mean, he's sticking around them for a reason. She's stuck.
What? I can't tolerate this. This is bad.
Well, no, you know what? I'm just saying it looks.
She's
really
the voice of
stage.
Reason.
Yeah.
And that reason. I was really thrown off by it, and I thought it was really inappropriate. But I'm just wondering if they changed their interactions in later performances, or if it really is that they are that intimate with each other.
I don't know.
I wanted to just go back to one thing, Andrew, that you said about Snape, because for me, what the biggest thing is, you're seeing a character brought back to life who, as you said, was killed very tragically in the books, and that's not the case for some of these other characters, right? Dumbledore still is remaining in a portrait. He's not back living and breathing in any scenes, at least that I can recall.
No.
McGonagall survived, so to see her alive is not as big of a shock. So, but when you bring somebody back like Snape, as you know, as important as he was, and as you know, tragic and flawed of a character, some people loved him, some people didn't love him. I just think that, you know, that's where people have the problem. You mentioned Alan Rickman, obviously. So, I just think the fact that you're bringing back such a major character that was killed off, and you're trying to give him life again in this way, it just comes across as being not easily digestible, and so that's where I can understand where a lot of people would have problems with it.
Yeah, and it just didn't feel like Snape. I mean, I think that's kind of a main recurring thing. It just felt wrong.
So moving along here, Snape resists believing Scorpius that there's an alternate reality where Voldemort lost and Harry won and Harry's still alive, of course, until Scorpius tells him he knows about Lily and about only Dumbledore knowing of Snape's love for Lily. And this moves Snape, because he realizes, well, shit, how else can he know this unless it's true that there is this alternate reality?
Right.
So Snape brings Scorpius to What is it called? The committee room or something like that. It's described in the script book as that. And the campaign room. That's it. And Ron and Hermione are there. And it turns out that these three have still been fighting the good fight, but there's not much left of Dumbledore's army. And so in the scene, I'm just wondering, what have Ron and Hermione been up to? Because Ron's described as having spiky hair, and Hermione is described as looking like disheveled and just like poor, I think.
Isn't it said they're tickling the nose hairs of anyone who gets near? That's exactly what Ron has been doing.
Hermione's not a teacher in this reality, right?
She's. But I like that she's like she's known as Granger, which is like a Muggle name, and she's using it to like get back and fight the fight.
It says in the book, her clothes faded, her eyes blazing. She is full warrior now, and it rather suits her.
Yeah,
but we don't learn Snape like what.
Come on,
kidding. The full warrior.
I'm kidding.
Wow, I didn't think this episode would end up with a Snape Hermione ship going on.
I know. Well, I didn't think that when I was going into the play.
Snermione, would that be their ship name?
Snermione? I don't know. Hermape? I don't know.
Sounds like a disease.
So we're talking about this, though. I'm reading this scene on page 184, too, where it's like Scorpius tells... Well, Hermione says, to be clear, in this other world, before you meddled, and Scorpius says, Voldemort is dead, killed in the Battle of Hogwarts, Harry is head of magical law enforcement, you're Minister for Magic. And she says, I'm Minister for Magic? And Ron says, brilliant, what do I do? And he's like, you run Weasley's Wizard Weezes. And she's like, okay, so she's Minister for Magic and I run a joke shop? But then like, and then it's like, where's Snape in all this? And Snape just like, I'm dead. And he knows it. And he knows that it all leads to this. And all of a sudden he's just like, how? And Scorpius says, bravely, and he says, who? And he says, Voldemort. It's just like, the way that Scorpius and Snape are playing off each other, it's too game-timey to me, where it's like, okay, we're going to get this done, fact convey, all the communication, how does this happen? And Scorpius is intuitive, he knows exactly what's, like, all Snape says is, how? And then Scorpius knows it's, oh yeah, you're death, you did this, this happened, and is able to lay down the facts so expertly. I'm like, I'm sorry, this is a little disbelievable for me, or unbelievable.
Well, I liked it because Snape realizes, again, that he needs to sacrifice himself.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of beautiful.
But in this timeline, they all sacrifice themselves.
True.
Yeah.
But not before equating Snape's love for Lily with Scorpius' love for Albus.
Don't you mean Rose?
No, I mean Albus. That's what he says.
That's not.
Exactly. Yeah, and actually one of the crazy things here is that Snape and Lily are directly compared to Albus Scorpius. That's what Snape says. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that doesn't mean that Albus
you
and Scorpius...
You would give up your kingdom for Albus?
Right, like I would for Lily or something like that. If that doesn't mean that those two are supposed to be together, I don't know what the hell does.
Well, fair enough.
So anyway, things get a little messy when Umbridge sees what's going on and Hermione realizes she has to let the Dementors come for her because they're moving in. And... there's a lot of pleasing of the Ron-Hermione shippers in this scene because Hermione says, I love you, Ron, and I always have.
I know.
Is this a direct response to that drama that happened a couple years ago where J.K. Rowling said that she was rethinking Ron-Hermione? Remember when she said it was a way of wish fulfillment?
This play, like, got Hermione and Ron together three different ways. Three different times.
Yeah.
Because then later, Ron wants to marry Hermione again.
Yeah.
Wants to renew the vows.
Yeah, because he admits he was drunk the first time. We were supposed to talk about this later, but I'll just say it now. I'm surprised that the Ron-Hermione marriage scene wasn't actually in the play, because I think people would have loved to have seen
it. Oh, if it ended with a wedding.
No.
Yeah.
And then Hugo can show up and be the ring bearer.
Right.
Hugo.
So then, and this was another great scene in the play. Ron says, oh, well, I'll let the Dementors come for me, too. And then they both get sucked up and they both get lifted from the stage and go up into the rafters, which was pretty beautiful as the Dementors pulled them up.
The Dementors were amazing.
Yeah, they were very wispy and large. And then Snape says farewell to Scorpius. And in another beautiful moment, he says to tell Albus he's proud that he carries his name. See, I love this play for moments like that. Like, these characters.
You're supposed to love this play for moments like that. That's exactly what's supposed to happen.
Hashtag fan service?
Yeah.
No, I think it's.
I think this was fan service, to be honest with you.
I just like the idea of Snape knowing that Harry decided to name his son after him. I think that's beautiful.
Snape knowing that he dies for a purpose too in both universes, that, you know, his
yeah.
death. He says, even he makes light of it. He's like, I suppose it's honorable to get dispatched by the Dark Lord himself. You know, he gets it, which is cool. You really expect a character like Snape to be able to put things, including his own life, in perspective that way.
So then in present day, the family finds out everything. So Harry, Ron, Hermione, Draco, they find everything out. And things are fixed now.
Except Scorpius lies.
Oh, about the time turner.
About the time turner. Yeah. He's like, oh, I dropped it. It's the bottom of the lake. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and I think his lie, I think it was okay in theory because he wanted to destroy it himself. I think that's okay. But of course, that plan backfires because then Delphi catches up to them in the Allery because Albus, although he doesn't know it at the time, he stupidly invites her to come along for the destroying ceremony.
Here's the thing. It's true that Scorpius does not plan on Albus owling Delphi. I can't keep my facts straight here. Owling Delphi and telling her, but and the excuse that he gives is, you know, these ministry people kept the time turner when they should have destroyed it once. Can you really trust them to have it again? But there's totally a scene where McGonagall and I think it's even Draco, but it might not be, they're in McGonagall's office and again talking about the time turner. It's just like, you know, I bet with McGonagall there in the room, if Scorpius had said, look, I have it, but I just don't trust you. If you don't destroy it, why don't you destroy it right now? Then they would destroy it. Like, I think that McGonagall would pressure them to destroy it then and there, and Scorpius should be sort of vindicated in his suspicions. Furthermore, it doesn't take a whole lot to destroy a time turner. Delphi sort of crushes it. I don't know if it's in her hand that she just crushes it or steps on it with her, like, high-heeled boot. I don't know what's going on here, but she just sort of crushes it. It doesn't take much. So I don't kind of... This is something that was... It was a decision that was made to deliberately drive the plot into yet another timeline to have a third or a fourth or a fifth leg to it. Like, it's mm-hmm. such a stupid action for Scorpius to lie.
For sure. But I also think, I mean, in this scene, I remember sort of, I think that the crux of it too was that Albus wanted Delphi there because he had a crush on her and Scorpius didn't want her there because he was like jealous. Like, legitimately jealous for friendship or other reasons. So I think that was sort of a thing of, you're right. I mean, it definitely was a thing of getting all three of them together to have a scene for the big reveal. Like, let's go to the Owlery and destroy this because she's an Augury. So it's bird theme, you know, like that's what it was. But, I just wanted to say as well, this was the point of where I like at once cheered and also got really mad because like, for having watched the play and not having obviously had time to read spoilers before or anything like that, we were all like saying, if Delphi is not evil, then she is literally the biggest Mary Sue of all time and we hate her. So she turned out to be evil, which was like a bit of vindication. But then immediately after finding out the whole Voldemort daughter thing, I was like, I wish she had just been a Mary Sue.
And there's parts of this story where even the character's dialogue, like, again, back to the scene with McGonagall real quickly. She says to Hermione, of all the stupid things, which is what Harry says to Albus when Albus is angry about the blanket. And I'm just like, and she says, this is when she found out that the time turn is still around. She says, and in a bookcase, you kept it in a bookcase. It's almost laughable. I read that line in the script coming from McGonagall to Hermione and I say, but it's not laughable. I'm not laughing. This is like the part where the writers are just like, we're going to have a character criticize some of the plot elements of this play so that we can all agree that it's a little weird and a little offbeat. And won't it be so much more fun and won't we be more okay with it?
I was
McGonagall is
too.
My favorite character in this for that very reason. I just think that you're right, Eric. She's drawing out the absurdity in some of this.
Yeah, she keeps it real for sure.
But like that almost works to make it easier to stomach, right? Like when you're watching the play, when you're reading, you know, to think about
it. Yeah. So So then Albus and Scorpius, they finally learn the truth about Delphi.
Because her cloak slips loose or whatever.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, on stage, I think, like, it was kind of obvious to us, too, that she was wearing something slightly different. And then she turns around and you see the wing on her back and Scorpius sees it at the same time. And yeah, so that all comes to life there. And then Delphi, I guess she hears about this whole humiliation thing and how it screwed everything up, and she goes, interesting. So she decides that they're going to go to the Quidditch pitch to humiliate Cedric again during the third task to get everything screwed up again. So that, in theory, Cedric will become a Death Eater again, and then Voldemort will rule because Nagini wasn't killed, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And then we come upon the one death in the play. Because Craig comes in, I think, at some point around here.
Who?
Craig.
Who?
Craig.
Craig!
Not Rip Craig.
My favorite character.
Not Craig.
Yeah, this...
The cursed child.
Yeah, truly. This kind of bothered me because it was the one death in the play, and it basically wasn't a death at all because we didn't know this character.
It was so much like Cedric. Like, it was it was too similar. Like, it really bothered me how out of their way they went to make him a new spare. You know, like.
But it was to show just how brutal Delphi is, right?
Yeah.
That she'll kill somebody.
It was. But it was such an obvious, like, that's why they did it thing that it bothered me.
It's interesting, fair. Though. Andrew, though, I would argue that everybody dies in this play. Like,
yeah,
Ron dies, Hermione dies, Harry dies, Albus dies, Snape dies.
But none of it counts because it's all in...
Except Craig.
Craig counts.
Yeah. And maybe the owl that was flying at the beginning of the play.
Oh, no, he just got fired. He didn't get...
The cursed owl. Harry Potter and the cursed owl.
Delphi has this line when they find her out, and she says, you're far easier to control than Amos. Children, particularly male children, are so naturally pliant, aren't they? And I thought that was actually a little bit interesting to hear, because it kind of evokes the themes of, like, Dumbledore manipulating Harry all those years. I thought it was sort of a profound quote coming from the villain. To know what you guys thought of it.
That's true.
Yeah.
Particularly
and then
male
another...
children. I wonder why that is. Like, I don't know.
Well, probably for her, because she can charm them.
Yeah.
Because they're all straight and stuff, so.
With her Audrey tramp stamp.
And then another moment similar to Snape finding out about Albus Severus. In the maze, Albus makes sure to tell Cedric that his dad loved him, which I thought was really sweet, because that was, again, making sure things are settled in the past. And this, in a way, is the best Albus can do at this point. Like, he knows he can't alternate time, but at least he can tell Cedric, he can let Cedric know that his dad loved him. And Cedric does not understand why he's saying this at all. He's like, okay, thanks. And then he moves on with his fight in the maze. But I just thought that was another beautiful moment. And I thought, I'm happy Albus did that.
I hated that moment.
Why?
I thought it was... Well, because now we're coming to the point... I should have been on part one because I loved so much that happened in that. But it was coming to the point where it just... Everything to do with the time turner, everything to do with rehashing the Cedric plot just really bothered me, because it was such a thing that should have been left in the past for me. And it was okay to have Cedric as this kind of ideal person. Like Neville, we never saw Neville, and that was like, that was upsetting, but it was okay. But then this was just, like, why did we have to end with him and Albus and Cedric getting to, like, Cedric was so much the, like, what Albus saw himself as, and just having that big, I guess they needed the confrontation, but it was so on the nose, and having him run around, like, why Cedric? It just brought home how pointless or how weird and that was to me.
Yeah. I agree with that. And I think, too, like, now you start to get into the territory which you really have to suspend some level of belief. I know we had one of our listeners, Miranda, write in about just the security surrounding this particular task of the Triwizard Tournament. You know, the fact that you had Moody on the outside, and really just the overall, you know, the feeling, the sense of something was really off about the Triwizard Tournament to begin with, because of course Harry's name comes out of the Goblet of Fire. So
that would lead to intense scrutiny. That,
you know, now you've had three times over two children the first two times, and now three children come back in time and try and influence the outcome of these events. And so it's weird that this is being written after the fact, because you can't in your own mind sort of go back to Goblet of Fire and, as you're rereading through it, identify moments where you think these events could actually transpire. And so that's where, as a reader, and to have to, according to J.K. Rowling, accept it as canon is a little bit difficult, at least for me to do.
Yeah, me too.
I just don't buy that Ron got sloshed with Neville in the Hogsmeade Tavern, and upon walking back, saw Albus walking with his old girlfriend to the Owlery, and they were standing on the roof, and he thought, oh, kids will be kids. Good thing my love potion set in. What does Ron exactly think that Albus and Scorpius are doing with the girl on the roof of the Owlery that his love potion was successful? What?
Threesome. Well, I did. That was a major stretch.
That's the entire reason.
What are the chances that they're at Hogsmeade and then happen to walk by the Hogwarts Owlery?
And that's exactly how.
Which is high up.
That's exactly how they know that they're in the past again later on, like in a moment. It's so weird. Like, why anybody thought that could work, that would be okay to write in this play. I don't get it.
And then at the end of Act 3, we learn that Voldemort had a daughter. This is arguably the biggest shocker coming out of the play, that is canon now. I mean, some people are refusing to accept it as canon, and that's fine. But that Voldemort had a daughter, and that is Delphi. And we find out in Act 4 that it was Bellatrix that he did it with, or something.
Or something.
Yeah.
Why?
Why did you do that to Rodolphus?
Why, like, bring in such a cliche to Harry Potter? I thought it was better than this, you know?
It was kind of...
There is another Skywalker moment, you know?
Exactly. Like, exactly. I was thinking about this morning or yesterday. It does... It's Star Wars-y.
Yeah. It's too much. It's too much like something we've seen before. It's too much like a cliche. Like, I'm sorry. I hold Harry Potter to higher standards than that.
Like, there's just something interesting about the character of Delphi that I would like to get more of. But I think even this play doesn't really contain all the cool parts of her character. Like, again,
she's so one-dimensional.
Well, the idea that she's actually secretly rallying these creatures for, like, an eventual rebirth of Voldemort, the reason that Harry's in the present, Harry's scar hurts again, all this stuff is actually kind of cool. And I want to know more about who exactly raised her. The fact that Rodolphus comes out of Azkaban and tells her that there's this prophecy or something. I don't get how all these pieces fit together. There's probably some form of interesting story behind there, but it's not how did she learn to fly? Like, that's just something that's like, this would be cool to perform on stage. Only one other wizard. This isn't the movies. This is the books. Only one other wizard could fly without a broom. It was Voldemort. And unless Voldemort himself taught her, how did she learn this stuff? Like, I really just so much
genetic.
Is left unanswered. I want to care about Delphi. Like, part of me wants to forget she ever existed. The other part wants to, like, actually the play to follow through on all of its BS.
You might want to forget her existence, but DH Fan on Twitter actually asked a really good question, which was, would Draco or his parents know if Bellatrix spent a few months pregnant, especially since Delphi was born at Malfoy Manor? So the fact that nobody else knows that she existed is a little strange, or that Bellatrix
was pregnant.
It's because
she didn't. Like, let's get real. No, it's not a thing.
Look, we saw this at the Leaky Mug, Cursed Child Leaky Mug at GeekyCon the other day. It's an undetectable extension charm placed on Bellatrix's womb, and, you know, you can never tell. She'd be pregnant the whole time, and you'd never know.
Well, yeah, and she's just... Yeah, so Bellatrix may have been in hiding...
Didn't Hermione polyjuice into her, like, when she was pregnant?
That's another thing.
I don't think that
would
work.
And then she would have been pregnant.
I don't think that would work.
That's how that works.
What do you mean? Yeah, what? Oh, you're saying like if you polyjuiced while pregnant.
We're talking about
you polyjuice into a person the way they look at the time when you polyjuice.
But that's another person. The baby's another person. Now we're getting into abortion, right, in magic, but.
I don't know.
The baby's another person, so it wouldn't be.
Yeah, but she would be, her body would, I don't know. It doesn't matter. Anyway, I think it's fine, but I just feel like this is another thing, like time travel and going back and rehashing Goblet of Fire, that I wish a new Harry Potter story would have been confident enough in its new characters and in its existing characters that it didn't have to rehash everything that had already happened and continue Voldemort's story with this made-up fake Voldemort 2.0.
Thank you, Selena. I agree with you 100,000.
And that's like where the disappointment comes in, you know.
Yep.
Okay. Well, so moving on here. I mean, there was this prophecy. I don't really want to get into the prophecy stuff. I kind of hated the prophecy stuff.
Oh, really? That's why you don't want to get into it?
What do you want to say, Micah?
No, just the fact that yet again we're dealing with another prophecy in the Harry Potter world, and you know it comes into play later because you know Scorpius is quick to tell her Delphi that in fact you know there's different ways of interpreting prophecies, or you don't truly have to believe in what they say, and you know that encourages her to really go back in time to Godric's Hollow and to try and prevent Voldemort from killing Harry in the sense that she believes that if she stops that from happening, she can basically rewrite the course of history. And so I just thought, you know, the way that Harry and Ron and Hermione and Draco are able to go and uncover this prophecy and then eventually the truth inside of her room is like, it's very like Criminal Minds, CSI, I don't know, Wizarding World. You know, it was just, I don't know. The prophecy was on the wall. Is that, you know, it was like written in blood.
What she wrote on the blood was that she was going to return her father. Didn't the prophecy come out of some sort of pot or, they unscrewed the top of a bottle it was kept in or something? Like,
it was like a lamp on the wall or something.
But
like
who
that.
Gave the prophecy? That's a question.
Well, who gave the prophecy? And also, why didn't the Ministry of Magic? See, this is something that we know that they have in place, a Department of Prophecy, which every time a prophecy is made, magically it gets copied and transferred and put on a shelf, in the Department of Mysteries for somebody to read, study. You know, this would have thrown up some red flags. It very specifically uses the term Dark Lord, and says, "We'll return." And if anybody's working in that department at the Ministry of Magic, they deserve to be fired for not immediately alerting, the then Minister for Magic for what was clearly a prophecy made about Voldemort coming back. Like, there's no way a real prophecy could exist without the Ministry knowing about it.
It was probably in all that paperwork that Harry never...
Right, yeah. It's like, well, yeah, I sent
must
you...
must have been.
Dear Mr. Yeah. Potter, per our previous attempts at contacting you, there's this prophecy you might want to come down and check out.
Yeah. Well, this act opens up very much. We talked about this. This is this, you know, McGonagall getting really angry at Hermione and others for the fact that the Time Turners were not... in fact destroyed. So she has her moment, and I know we're all very much in agreement with her. But then, you know, we're transported all the way back to 1981 in Godric's Hollow, and so this plan starts to be formulated by both, well, really it's Albus who starts to think through, and quite honestly, I don't know what you all thought of this, but the blanket, right? It's such a stretch.
It's such a stretch.
Yeah,
I agree
magic,
with you.
The magic and the potions and the burning, and Bethilda has potions to do it too.
She leaves her door unlocked and you can get
right.
in. I don't know.
And Harry keeps the blanket with him.
All
like,
of
that's
it,
not anything
well,
we ever saw before.
Okay, all of it together might be like construed as being a stretch, but I think there are little hints here and there in the play. Like if the play had been less or had been about less things, you would have seen these other like clue-ins more clearly, like Polly Chapman asking Scorpius to the blood ball. The blood ball clearly takes place on Halloween. And so that's to indicate that in present day, it's getting closer to Halloween, which is when Harry holds the blanket close to him and cries a little bit. So
I like that. though. Yeah. I like that Harry wants to be with it every Halloween.
Me too. I like that a lot. It's the closest thing, right up until the point where they have Harry physically witness his parents' death from down on the street corner. The blanket is, and they should never have done that. The blanket is the closest thing that Harry has, and I think I like the blanket.
Oh, but they died right behind me, though, guys.
Oh, they did?
They were standing right behind me.
In the audience?
Oh, yeah.
What?
Right behind our row.
Yeah,
were like, no!
Describe what that was, because I was up on the higher level, so I couldn't see any of that happening.
So you didn't see Lily James die?
No, we didn't see it. It was it happened like the characters were all standing at the top of the stage, looking out into the audience down, because we were in the back row and the bottom. So there was like all the stuff that happened at the top of the stage. We couldn't see it all. None of the like amazing Dementor stuff. But we did get to see Voldemort walk down right next to us through the middle line, and then he disappeared behind the back blanket. And then there were actors standing there. We could see the silhouettes of them. And they were just screaming and dying.
And Harry, and then, like, Ron,
Harry
and Hermione
was looking like at us
at
because they were looking at right behind us and just like emoting to us, which was a little bit weird.
That
and
was
took me a little bit out of it, at least. But it was emotional for sure.
That was really effective, I thought. Harry, Ron, and Hermione all staring into the audience, is basically staring at the entire audience. Like you're staring back at them. You're staring at each other and watching Harry watch his parents die. That's very hard to watch.
It was very hard. It was actually like the closest I got to those tears that J.K. Rowling promised us.
Oh, not the Hagrid scene. The next
no.
Oh, I cry while reading that.
It was not. That did not work for me. But you guys know my thoughts on Hagrid.
I see the death of Lily and James, like Harry having to witness it, as the ultimate epitome of being on the nose. Right? Like, like it doesn't mean anything for Harry, like, until he actually sees it. I just don't think it was necessary.
Part of me likes it because, remember, when Harry Potter series was still going on, the biggest theory was there was someone else there at Deathly Goddard's Hollow the night that Harry's parents die. And part of me liked that they went back to it and actually said, yes, they were all there. Another part of me feels like this is another sort of sacred part of Harry Potter mythology that they should not have messed with.
Right. I tend to agree with that. That was one of the biggest issues that I had with the story, is that while I'm sure it's very powerful to watch it played out and seeing Harry, Ron, Hermione watch what happens to James and Lily, and they're making the conscious decision to watch and to not intervene.
And to face it together.
As you said, Selena, it's sort of a sacred moment within the series. It's how the series really starts. And the fact that, maybe somebody else was there. We knew Snape eventually.
Sirius Black.
Shows up. Sirius. Yeah. Hagrid. So it feels like you're going into territory that should be off limits. And the fact is that now you're supposed to believe in full that when this is all playing out in Sorcerer's Stone and mentioned in other books, that Harry was there the whole time watching what transpired. And to me, like, there's just something inherently wrong with that.
It cheapens the whole thing. Also because, like, a lot of the stuff, like, you know that this was not what happened when she wrote the original series. Like, maybe a few things, but not this. I don't think so.
Well, we kind of glossed over the fact that there is a second time turner that they're using to be back in time.
Oh, yeah.
That Draco had it all along, that there was this crazy rumor where Draco sends his wife back in time to sleep with Voldemort. That's not true, but him having a time turner is true. You know,
and this is too where it was mentioned about Lucius and how he preferred, or at least Draco seemed to believe that he preferred a world without Voldemort. So it gave you a little bit of a deeper insight into really Draco in this particular, I think it's Act 4, Scene 4, right? When they're in Harry's office and they're talking as if they're friends and they see each other as friends. And I think it's mentioned for the first time. And of course, at the beginning of that chapter, there was something I wanted to talk about specifically, which was Harry's conversation with Dumbledore. And it was just, it seemed very off base to me. I know Harry comes across Dumbledore in a portrait form earlier in this play. And again, that seemed a little bit off the way that they interacted with each other. But now you know, they end on a good note, but it's just the way that it's written. It just does not seem to me like traditional Harry, traditional Dumbledore. And I wanted to get your thoughts on it. You know,
well,
Harry sarcastically says, "Where have you been, Dumbledore?" And he says, "I'm here now." Like, what?
I mean, putting aside the obvious, you know, breaking news, this isn't exactly penned by J.K. Rowling. I did like the scene on stage, actually.
Okay.
I thought it was pretty epic to see Dumbledore and Harry back together again. And I thought, I'm trying to find the exact, what page is it? Do you have it open?
It's page 256. But just saying things like, "Professor Dumbledore, in my office, I'm honored. I must be where the action is tonight." Like,
well, was that sarcasm?
I don't know.
That was sarcasm.
There's no italics that indicated
well,
as being
Dumbledore
sarcasm.
Is so popular in this day. He has so many portraits made of him. I think that part made sense.
Because Harry's face is passive and Harry is hurriedly going through paperwork. So I think it's assumed that he just doesn't really have time for Dumbledore at the moment. But I just, you know, I thought it was a good conversation between these two, and Dumbledore has some good things he wants to say, and he starts openly sobbing, right? At some point.
You made Dumbledore cry. There you go, cursed child. Way to go. You made Dumbledore cry.
Look what you did.
Just to get some few extra moments between Harry and Dumbledore, even though Dumbledore, as it is established, he is just a portrait, so he's not really helpful, but I thought he had some interesting things to say.
But I don't think that there needed to be the conversation about love. I think it was made very clear in Deathly Hallows and even, you know, Half-Blood Prince probably more so, that obviously Dumbledore cared for Harry. And, you know, that.
Yes.
I feel like this is just reiteration of that. And I don't think as fans that we needed that, right? I mean, I think we know that he cared for him as a son, as a grandson, however you want to look at it. And I just feel like.
Well, it's probably one of the things where it's not only made for the fans, you know, this play. And I think this is one of the reasons where it sort of gives the game away.
And this story, remember, is about fathers and sons. And Harry, he didn't have a traditional father, so Dumbledore was in many ways a father figure to him. So
I
guess
that's...
Oh my
God, I love how Harry is like, "I never had a father figure." And you just see the Sirius and Remus and Hagrid being all Arthur.
Sirius more than anyone. That's what jumps to mind every time I read that. That's who jumps to mind every time I read that part. But yeah, so I think Harry did need a conversation with a father in this book, and this is one of them. I love Dumbledore's thoughts on perfection. Perfection is beyond the reach of humankind, beyond the reach of magic.
Do you think Jo wrote the Dumbledore parts?
I think it occurred to me that really sounded a whole lot more like Dumbledore.
Parts did.
Yeah.
Not the whole thing. But I know we don't want to spend too much time on that. So, you know, just kind of fast forwarding, because we talked a little bit about, you know, the blanket. And so now, I mean, unless there's anything else to kind of touch on, I think we can go to the church itself when everybody...
Saint
Jerome.
Take
me to the church. Take me to church, Micah.
There was this... I did want to mention the graveyard is apparently very haunted. Scorpius says the Godric's Hollow graveyard is supposedly very haunted. And I was just thinking, what purpose does that line have in this play? Because in the Wizarding world, haunted... You know, if there are ghosts, we see them. And there's definitely no ghosts hanging around the graveyard that have any role in this play.
I think it's just to demonstrate his knowledge. That particular part of the this play, like, he's talking a lot about just things in Godric's Hollow that Albus doesn't seem to be aware of. I mentioned earlier the statue. He's just very knowledgeable, and I think...
Right. You know, they've given him all the cards because Albus says... Oh, Scorpius is like, "Didn't your father ever take you here?" And Albus is like, "Ah, he wanted to, but I said no." You know, it's like, "Oh, you were just a dick to your dad all your life, and that's why you've never been here." But, like, it forces Scorpius to know more than he should about everything here. Scorpius is the guiding light. Scorpius is the ultimate character who's able to talk about all of these inhabitants of Godric's Hollow and where they should go and what they should do and see. I just find it ridiculously convenient. But that graveyard line about it being haunted has no purpose in this play. So I'm just going to call that out.
I understand. It displays a lack of understanding for how the wizarding world exists, and it bothers you. I understand that.
So the church scene, what do we want to say about it? I thought it was nice that it was set in a church. It's kind of symbolic. We did just touch on it a few minutes ago. I thought it was noble that, so Delphi, I guess it is, who manages to lock all the doors, while Harry is trying to convince her that to get into the light so that the rest of them can move in, and they don't want to kill her, which I thought was interesting. I think, cause it's a test, right? There's these mentions of there being tests in the story between Albus and Scorpius, and something they learn is that they're not killers. I think either Ron or Hermione say that. And this is a good reminder that these are good people who, even though they're fighting evil, they are not going to go down to their level.
I liked this scene so much better when it was at the end of Prisoner of Azkaban. And I like this scene a whole lot less now.
Ouch.
They're going to put her in Azkaban, which I thought was kind of weird because there have been multiple breakouts at Azkaban. So,
including her own mother.
right. So it's like, I don't know if that's the best place to put her in case it happens again. But I thought it was interesting. What was I going to say? I lost my train of thought.
You got to leave the possibility of a sequel open. All those creatures that are on the move that aren't ever really readdressed, she's just going to break out of Azkaban and pick right up.
Yeah, well, but there is this moment, this is what I was going to say, that Delphi kind of just breaks down and is like, I just wanted to see him again. And Harry says, you know, something about being an orphan. They relate over... What?
You said you'll be an orphan forever. That'll never leave you. That's who you are.
Right. And at that point, to me, it kind of seemed like Delphi was ready to accept that she wasn't going to fight this fight anymore. But I don't know.
Yeah. I want to know how they really transfigured Harry into Voldemort.
Something about a cloak and a hole in the floor, I think.
Mm.
It was hard to see. It was cool. I find that the transfiguration bits, like the time travel effect, like I got a little bit tired of it when we'd seen it a couple of times, which sounds so ungrateful or ungrateful because it was really cool, but after like seeing Transfiguration, because they did it a lot in this play, so I was just at that point, I was just like, okay, we get it.
Yeah,
and it took a long time for them to, because they couldn't really get Voldemort out of the cloak, so I was just like,
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was some cool stage magic going on with that and the Polyjuice Potion. I think with the Polyjuice Potion, there were two people in the cloaks simultaneously. Because, their head...
It was the same here, right?
I guess so, yeah. Their head would kind of fall back and the new head would pop out. It was really well done.
Yeah.
I like also this idea that Harry has to portray Voldemort, that he's the only one who can really be good enough at it to convince her to lure her in as a trap.
I thought that was crap. Ginny could have done that.
Ginny has this line about the man she loves being shrouded in the man she hates. And I was like, this is just... It's an interesting scenario to see played out. It's like... It was probably an idea that looked good on paper, and they're like, we got to get this into this play somehow.
One of our listeners listening live via Patreon right now, Grace, she says, one of my fave parts of this play is that Ginny tells Albus bad people traumatized the innocent most often. I found that to be a very powerful moment that is never quite articulated in the actual play.
Mm, that's true. That's a good line.
Mm-hmm.
I also like how in the play, like when we saw it, it was Albus actually hugged Harry at this point. He ran into Harry's arms, not Ginny's arms. I thought that was much more effective.
Yeah. And, you know, rereading this, I had a greater appreciation for the father-son story overall because Harry and Draco realize in Act 4 that they need to, that they've been trying to give their sons what they themselves needed to rewrite their past, not what the kids needed. So when Harry realizes this, and Draco, you start seeing these moments of where they're trying to look out for their sons more. They're trying to figure out their sons' needs.
Well, it's a good thing that James Potter, Harry's son, turned out to be so good and like not and low maintenance, really, because that second kid though, he's a real
and Lily
firecracker. Yeah,
yeah, she just wants fairy wings.
Or augury wings.
Here's that line that Ginny said that the listener pointed out. That's what they're good at, Albus, catching innocents in their web. I wonder if that's trying to tie back to the Cedric Diggory plot.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Probably.
Yeah, I don't know.
And then at the end of the play, since we already talked about the murder of Harry's parents, watching that, being very emotional, the play closes, not with Ron and Hermione getting married, but...
No!
With Harry and Albus on a beautiful hill, and they're at Cedric's grave, and Harry reveals
Cedric Diggory again.
Why was Cedric's grave? Why was Cedric buried like right off Hogwarts grounds?
Mm-hmm. And well, how do say that?
Because Dumbledore,
well, I got
they
that
have
impression.
A graveyard. Isn't it at a walk? Hogwarts, don't they?
Isn't it a walk? I thought the only one to be buried on the grounds was Dumbledore, and that was special, and that was. I could be wrong.
I thought that Hogwarts had a graveyard, but. That might
is it haunted?
That might
is it supposedly it very haunted?
Yeah, it's very, very haunted, Eric.
No, it's supposed to be
ghosts.
Written in, I thought, right? I agree with Selena. I had heard at some point J.K. Rowling, you know, prior to her finishing the series, had said that Hogwarts does have a graveyard, and I guess it was up to speculation whether or not it was going to be included in the series. Obviously, it wasn't, but...
Mm-hmm. I wonder why his father didn't, you know, take him home.
But it's not even established that Cedric's grave is at Hogwarts.
Well, here's my misunderstanding then, because Harry says we have to go for, or Albus says I have to go on a walk with my father. And is so I just assume they walked from Hogwarts to get there.
Like, yeah, okay. That was my assumption, that Cedric was buried somewhere on the grounds.
Okay. I think that would be right for Cedric, unless it's, I guess it would have been up to his father, really.
Yeah.
Dumbledore strong-armed him, was like, I need him as a symbol.
He's the Hogwarts champion. You have to let him yes. be buried at Hogwarts. Yeah, probably.
But I think the other nice part about this is that Albus learns that Harry is kind of trying to do right, that Cedric wasn't forgotten because Harry is visiting his grave regularly. That's what we learn in this scene. So it's not like Albus...
He wasn't really a spare.
Right.
You know, at all. Or,
and he wasn't... Right. And he still hasn't been forgotten.
Mm.
Just like that blanket.
Just like the play will never let us forget Cedric Diggory. Oy.
And that's the cursed child.
Yeah. Can we all agree that the Malfoys won cursed child?
Like, yeah. I
they
think
are for sure the ones that came out on top.
I think Rose so. Won.
And you
what?
Know what?
No way.
She got a reprieve. She didn't have
she
to be
lost.
In most of it. She didn't
Rose
have to be
won
in most of it.
She got the best best character.
I was going to say she was the cursed child because they wrote her out of the story almost completely to the point where it was ridiculous.
I agree about the Malfoys, but mm-hmm. I also looked up the I guess there was an interview with Alfonso Cuarón around Prisoner of Azkaban about a graveyard. And
oh, cool.
It says there's a scene where Malfoy wants to see Buckbeak being executed. It's where Hermione punches him. And there's a sundial. We thought we need something there. And I said, let's put a graveyard there. And she says, no, you can't have a graveyard there. And I'm like, why? Because I'm sure that's how Alfonso would have responded.
Why?
She says, oh, because the graveyard is near this other wing of the castle. And it's going to play an important part in number six, such and such and such.
In number six?
Well, Dumbledore.
It must be Dumbledore.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But we didn't get a lot of specifics.
It isn't like the films where it's on an island in the middle of nowhere.
No.
IKEA. There's an IKEA
Forget
there.
Forget the films.
Yeah. Forget the films. It's hard to do. But I need
tweet at J.K. Rowling. Get more information.
Some people readers who didn't see the play, which obviously it's a lot of people, you don't really get Scorpius's persona in this.
He's so amazing.
Yeah, and I have seen complaints that like, oh, this reads so badly because of some of Scorpius's dialogue, like that a quivering line.
But he delivers everything
exactly.
perfectly. It's, like, yeah. Oh my god.
Yeah.
He can
exactly.
make the worst and that's an amazing, like, sad thing about reading this play on script is that a lot of the stuff, like especially everything Scorpius says, like it's the intonation, it's the energy, mm-hmm. it's the presence of him. Like Anthony Boyle, that's like one of the articles, the first articles I wrote that made us hashtag Wormtail. It was like Anthony Boyle is amazing, and he just slays everything in this play.
Exactly.
So the Malfoys do rule.
They do, and Draco too. Like I've described him as like being borderline fanfic Draco because he is so, like, so nice, and so like he has the upper hand,
yeah,
like morally so much of Harry in this play.
Scene one
like,
of Act
flirts
Four,
with Ginny and stuff.
Yeah, scene one of Act Four. He says Hermione and Harry have done nothing wrong but try and protect us all. If they're guilty, then I am too. And he steps forward, mm-hmm. and I'm like. Where is this coming from? But,
I know.
Whatever.
Well, he matured, and that's fair enough. But it's a lot of, like, Draco and Scorpius are, in my opinion, the ones that sort of win the every scene that they're
in. You know who loses? Yeah. Hugo and Neville and Teddy and...
And Teddy Lupin.
And Sirius and all the other people.
It just wasn't time. There wasn't time. Yeah. Unless we
in
did
5 hours.
Three and four.
See, that's really the thing. In 5 hours of produced theater, there's no time to do some of this other stuff that... It might have been, I don't know.
We need more time.
Well, and we've said this. I think I've said this on the podcast before. The play moves quickly. I don't remember any moments where I was like, this is too slow. Keep it going. Let's move on.
We don't
and
have
if
time.
I saw it again, I don't think I would want any scene to not have been in there. So. Yeah.
No, it's interesting. It essentially functions as a full... production, and it seems like every moving part that's involved in this production is like works really well as a full finished product.
Yeah, it does. A couple of listener tweets here from people who follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/mugglecast. Soprano Swag says V&B really goes against canon from the series in that he hated affection, was waiting for the two Slytherins to be a couple.
No one says they.
I guess he's mean.
No one says Voldemort and Bellatrix made love. Okay, nobody says that.
So what do you guys make of that? Voldemort, yes, he did not. He wasn't one for romance, but you could argue that Voldemort did it. Was willing to do it because he would be in power during the sex, and
well,
he loves power.
I think it's weird though, because I think it's like either way you look at it. I mean, that's fair enough. And I don't want to get into too much like, oh, it's not canon, because there are plenty of people very willing to argue that yes, it is canon compliant. Mm. That's fine. But I think for me, it's like either he did it with the specific aim of having a child, which he would never do because he was so self-obsessed and wanted to live forever. So the idea of having an heir just seems totally like that's not something Voldemort would do. Someone who could potentially rival his power, no way. Or he did it for quote unquote pleasure, which also, in my opinion, I agree with Soprano Swag, which is like an amazing name, by the way, that I don't think that is something that Voldemort, as we knew him in the books, would have any interest in. A physical pleasure or in a moment of quote unquote losing control or whatever you want to say. Like, it's just not something that is congruous with Voldemort as we know him, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Hmm.
And I was also waiting for the two Slytherins to be a couple.
I'm still hoping that J.K. Rowling has something to say about this. She's been very quiet since the book came out, and I think I speculated on the last episode that this just proves to me that she just doesn't care what people think of the script book. Because that's not how it's intended to be consumed. She realizes she had to release the script book.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't love the idea that she had to. And so she's not going to address it. Yeah,
it doesn't read well when you haven't seen the play.
Exactly. To some people, it did, to be fair. Some people really liked the book. And I've noticed that older generations have liked it more than people, say, my age. And I think the reason why is like people who are parents. If you're a parent, you can understand this story more, I think.
I have noticed that the people who are more movie fans like this more than people who are book fans, because it is like it's more compliant with the tone of the films and the level of detail of the films than it is with the books.
Mm. Hmm.
I find that interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
And I'm good to believe it. I don't know. I don't like the idea that Joe would have written something that's over our heads, you know, the original fans. If it's the case that the parenting is somehow means more to an actual parent. I think that's fair. But I don't know. I just think Joe was always great at explaining adult concepts very well to children in the 7 books. So I hate to think that we were sort of left out and that was not properly conveyed to us, that we would get less out of a book.
It's also parenting thing that we don't appreciate. It's the dumbing down of things that were made so rich in the books, you know?
Exactly. If you come in putting this up, holding this up to the original series, you just can't do that. And to be fair, the marketing kind of misled people. The Barnes & Noble, I keep bringing this up. They had signs right at the front of the stores. Harry Potter is back! The 8th story! Like, well, you're assuming fairness, it's a new Harry Potter book.
The back cover of the book says the eighth story 19 years later. Mm. So yeah. I think that there's misdirection there as well. You know, yeah. It's, so anyway, I do like what Chuck Topping tweeted in, though. Also a great Twitter handle said, will we get a book to find out that Delphi is Scorpius's godmother and the real cursed child is Arnold the Pygmy Puff?
Yes. Yes.
But that
who's the cursed child, guys?
Who is it? It's multiple people.
Yeah, it is multiple people. It's Albus for not living up to his father.
It is not.
It is Albus for not being able to live up to his father.
He's one of them, for sure.
It's also Delphi.
Absolutely.
She's cursed in many ways. Yeah.
I don't subscribe to being multiple people because I think that's a cop out. Like, there's one cursed child.
Okay, well then
child.
you tell me who's on the front of the book. Who's in the nest?
Delphi. Delphi is on the front
totally
of the book.
A boy.
No, it's her wings.
It's a boy.
No. The wings and the nest. It's an augury nest.
There's a boy in
it's
that
Delphi.
Nest.
It's Delphi. Yeah, I know.
It's Albus.
But he's in her nest. It's her. She's the wings.
No, but that means both of them are cursed.
No, isn't like the cursed child has to be in the, like, that's the only person.
Isn't
on the
it
cover.
A snitch? I thought it was
no,
a snitch.
No, it's Archery wings and a nest.
Yeah, she wears those exact wings on stage.
So I think I think it's Delphi is the cursed child for sure. I was writing an article about it and I convinced myself that it was actually Cedric. Like, you can read that on Hyperbole if you want to read my crazy way of getting to that conclusion. He's the cursed child. He was literally cursed with death, and he never grew up.
Vampirism,
so he's
a
child
a
forever.
And being ridiculed.
Yeah, true.
Selena,
so,
the voice of reason.
It's Cedric. Yeah, no, but I don't think it's multiple people. I think that's a cop-out.
I think it's very J.K. Rowling for it to have multiple meanings.
No. Yeah. Wait, what other title of a book has referred to multiple people?
I'm not saying titles,
I think that's
but I'm
what
just saying
makes
Joe
cool.
in general has...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they were all cursed. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
It could also be
well, the Order of the Phoenix, that's multiple people.
That's true, but
that's
it is
too,
one
that's
order
too literal,
of one
I'm
phoenix.
DH Fan also wrote in, we answered their question earlier, but continued to say, while reading the play, it felt like the writers had a strong few moments that were strung together to make a clumsy story. And what was with Dumbledore? It seemed like the writers were trying too hard to get emotional reactions. It fell flat.
Yeah.
Kieran
it was all in the acting.
Kieran writes in, always had a hard time imagine Voldy doing normal things like eating, sleeping, peeing, etc., having to add sex to that list.
Yep.
Yeah. Vernon writes in, my issue with it is how powerful Delphi is. She beat the crap out of an adult Ministry of Magic, Harry. Your thoughts?
Mary Sue.
It is Harry Potter, after all, though. He probably isn't doing his homework. He probably didn't take one self-defense lesson after defeating Voldemort, because he's like, what's the point? I got the biggest baddie. I don't need to protect myself or the world that I live in now. That's how I feel.
True.
Well, and Delphi says in the book, in part two, that she's been watching Harry for a while, so she learned his strengths and weaknesses, I guess, is what we're supposed to believe.
That's also pretty cool. I like that goes to what I was saying about the unexplained Delphi backstory, where, you know, she presumably was able to watch Harry closely without him knowing it. Probably years before she showed up in his house as the niece of Amos.
Mm.
So,
and we all know that Harry is not like, I mean, his secret weapons are love and his friends. And that's what saved him this time, too. So it makes sense.
By the way, so this poll, Selena mentioned her Who is the Cursed Child article. We put a poll at the bottom of it. 40% say it's Delphi Riddle, and only Delphi Riddle.
Woo.
But 20%, the second most popular selection, said it's all of them, and the play should have been called Cursed Children.
There you go.
That would give it away.
Well, it's too easy. I mean, it's too easy to say all of them. I think it's Delphi for
sure.
It's
not all of them. It's just both of them. It's just Delphi and Albus. That's all it is. It's both of them.
And third place is Albus Potter with 17% of the vote. So
yeah, how much does Craig get?
7%. That's a pretty good. He's in third.
Well, he was literally
Delphi
the cursed
and
child.
Yeah, exactly. Craig was cursed with death.
I just love that you included Craig in this poll.
He should get some love, right? I mean,
exactly. He was my favorite character.
He doesn't have any parents. He's such a one-layered person. They'll probably just leave him on the Quidditch pitch and bury him there.
No, I don't think so. Maddie Jay tweeted in to say, Voldemort is right there. Just kill him. Save your parents, Cedric, Jorkins, Old Man, Sirius, Riddle, Family, Dumbledore, Dobby, Snape, Fred, possibly Lavender Brown. I don't know. Everyone?
Yeah, no, but you can't do that. He had the Horcruxes already, though. Again. Yeah.
Yeah, and it takes out the whole... whole epic story in the original series, so we couldn't do that.
You can't kill him because you have to find the Horcruxes before you can kill him.
That's true.
And finally, Christina Vorkos, who tweeted in definitely more than 140 characters, but a very strong proponent of the Cursed Child, said the second part was even stronger than the first. It made more sense where the story was going. I absolutely liked how it ended. The story was about the importance of friendship and family, similar to what Selena just said. Ultimately, love, always. That's what matters at the end. We see growth in the characters and the relationships from friendship, father and son, and with the couples, Harry and Ginny and Ron and Hermione. I think Delphi, without love, was made to believe that she was the daughter of Voldemort. She wanted to escape being an orphan. Delphi is the cursed child. So there you go. She is the one in the design. Her upbringing and the rumors were designed to bring Voldemort back. Delphi's first name was foreshadowing to her character, that she was untrustworthy and believed in prophecies, referring to Delphi Grease. The second time I read the script, it was even better than the first time. I could really understand where the story was going.
I mean, the interesting thing here is that she's kind of suggesting that Delphi wasn't really the child of Voldemort, which was actually something I was saying as well, that if that had been the case, I would have really liked that part of the story, because I love the idea of Delphi being this messed up, like crazy girl who had been made to believe that she was the daughter of Voldemort for some like evil Death Eater plot, you know? But I think the play made it very clear that she's actually the real daughter of Voldemort, which I thought was a shame, because it would have been more powerful if she hadn't been.
I liked part two more too, as evidenced by the fact that I think we had a deeper discussion here on MuggleCast today than we did with part one. There was a lot more
trashing in part one, I think, of the overall story, right?
Well, I think part one's the hardest to get through. Act one is the hardest to get through, like, because it shakes things up so vibrantly, and then, you know, the rest of the play is just sort of a falling action from all of the... It's like the dust settling in a way.
Yeah. I love the family stuff. I wish the entire play had been family stuff. Without the time travel and Voldemort's daughter, I think it would have been very powerful.
I agree. I agree with that.
So that does it for this week's episode of MuggleCast. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on Patreon this week. We're going to have more... Because guess what? We've been talking about Cursed Child so much that we haven't had time to talk about the news, and there's been a lot of news.
Lots of news.
Three new Harry Potter books are coming out next month. Did you guys hear?
Oh my gosh.
new Harry, J.K. Rowling
Brand
lied.
9, 10, and 11?
Yeah, yep. J.K. Rowling lied when she said she was done with Harry. At least that's what I read on E! Online.
She's done with Harry. Pottermore isn't done with Harry. Nobody else who can make money off Harry is done with Harry.
So we're going to talk about these new Harry Potter books. According to Time, Time Magazine told me new Harry Potter books. Very excited. And then there's been some Fantastic Beasts news to talk about, including a new type of Legilimens in Fantastic Beasts. Mm-hmm. Also, apparently there's much more on the horizon from J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. This is what WB said the other day. And a Harry Potter character will have a significant role in Fantastic Beasts 2. Someone's coming back. We're going to discuss all these things.
It's Craig!
On Bonus MuggleCast on Patreon, coming out very shortly after $2.99. So we'd love if you support us if you haven't already. Patreon.com/MuggleCast. We're actually on our way to returning to weekly episodes of MuggleCast. We may get there. Mm-hmm. And boy, we're going to have to think of some stuff to talk about if we hit weekly MuggleCast. I'm actually rereading the books right now.
Well, there looks to be plenty. We could have done two shows. You know, as we joked about the fact earlier, we could probably have done an episode per act of this play, just because there's so much to talk about.
Let's do scene by scene.
I would just get so upset.
Page by page.
Eric wouldn't last through it.
No.
And then T-shirts, right? They're coming.
Yeah. So for those of you who are patrons, it's too late to get a MuggleCast T-shirt. But if you were, if you pledged already, if you were signed up by August 1st, you are getting one. We ordered the T-shirts. They are coming to my house within the next week or so, and then they're gonna start going out. Cool. And they look great. We got some samples. They look awesome. and we can't wait for everybody to get theirs. But also on Patreon, if you do support us, you will receive signed album art. No matter when you sign up, you will receive that, plus tons of bonus MuggleCast installments. We're doing our book readings, doing a whole lot more over on there. Eric did a blog recently.
Yeah, I want to thank the two people, the two listeners who sent in birthday cards for us at the MuggleCast P.O. Box, which I'll give you the address again. It's 4044 North Lincoln Avenue, Box 144, Chicago, IL 60618. We got some cards for our 11th birthday and some candy, but I ate the candy. Sorry, guys. Actually, there's a video. There's a video of me opening it.
Send it.
Yeah, there's a video of me opening it on Patreon. So thank you to Sonia and Amanda for their gifts and their kind words.
Great. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And we will see you next time for our Mega MuggleCast episode 300.
Wow.
Selena, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We should plug Hype Podcast that you do.
Oh, yes,
Hypeable.
Please do. Hype actually did, Hype Podcast did some Cursed Child specials as well recently.
Awesome.
If you want even more discussion by not just me, but other Hype hosts.
As a matter of fact, I was on one of them.
I wasn't on that one. So you can hear Eric too. And that's over on hypeable.com in the podcast section. We also talk about all the latest entertainment news.
Yeah.
Every week.
It's a great show.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
He's not on anymore.
No, I'm not, but I will happily come back if you invite me. I'm a little hurt that Eric got invited over me. But, and Mike is hurt that he's just never been invited at all.
Oh, my God. We have to have Eric. My God.
All right, we'll see everybody next time for episode 300. Goodbye.
300. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.